from KQED.
Support for the California Report comes from Wharton San Francisco's Executive MBA program, delivering a rigorous academic experience immersed in the unique Bay Area ecosystem and access to a globally connected network. Wharton.upenn.edu. The California Endowment, working to achieve health and justice for all. Learn more at calendow.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.
On today's California Report magazine, we visit the office of an LA therapist who keeps hearing about a recurring character in her patients' dreams, President Trump.
This dream covers so many things. You're dealing with your own heartbreak around the election and also a lot of people feeling stabbed in the gut.
And why coming out as undocumented is a lot like coming out of the closet.
People need to know that queer people exist. And people need to know that undocumented people exist. And that we live next door and that we brush our teeth and that we floss or don't floss just like everybody else.
I'm Sasha Coca, and this is the California Report magazine. We start our show today with the story of a commute, a Sunday morning commute to go to church. It's a journey African-American residents priced out of cities and into suburbs often make to worship in the places where they used to live. We've been following some of those people who've moved out to the suburb of Antioch, a Bay Area community which has seen its Black population triple over the last 20 years. Today, KQED's Sandhya Dirks reports on why African-American residents are trying to put a stop to that Sunday exodus and grow churches right in their newly adopted community.
It's kind of fitting that this story about establishing Black church in a new homeland takes place in a city called Antioch. It is, after all, a biblical name.
There is no way you can have the city of Antioch and name it after the one that is in the Bible and not have Jews and Gentiles, Blacks and whites and brown, getting along, everybody, if we are actually going to live up to the name of the city.
Antioch was the place Christians were first called Christians.
Father, you are the Prince of Peace, and that it only can be peace, Father, if we have control.
Pastor Lamont Francis is the pastor at Delta Bay Church of Christ in Antioch. He preaches in a long room in a converted warehouse. It's got low ceilings and a booming, sometimes screeching sound system. People move towards the front of the room to pray with church elders. They hold hands and whisper. A woman sobs, weeps in a really naked way. This happens every Sunday I come to church. Someone breaks down, someone's sick, or their kid is struggling, or maybe working has worn them thin. 100 little reasons to cry. And this, it's a place that it's okay.
Start the healing process. It's a process. It's not going to happen overnight. It's a process. But start it. Start it. Look up. Look up to him.
As the Black middle class moved to the suburbs, and then the gentrification of the urban inner cities, people were coming in just to have worship or service, but they were not actually being the salt of the community.
Lamont says that's commuter church.
The commuter church is when you have people that do not live in that community that attend a local congregation.
On the flip side, Lamont says, is community church, something that had to be built out here. To build community church in these new places, you start anywhere you can.
So we had church in Starbucks, and we had church in the Antioch Library. There were times we had nowhere to go, and we just went to somebody's living room. So it was really grassroots. And as gas prices went up, our membership went up. Black churches do more than just come together to have church for 2 hours.
There's the Wednesday night Bible study, or the men's group that meets on Tuesdays at the pastor's home. Then there was a Saturday night last fall where the church called people together for a pretty tough conversation.
Good evening.
Good evening.
Okay, I just want to make sure you guys are awake.
More and more videos of black men killed by police were going viral. Across the country, a lot of people were talking about police and communities of color. In Antioch, Lamont felt there wasn't a space for this kind of dialogue. So he and some of his fellow black clergy decided to host a community forum at his church. About 50 people were in attendance. It was mostly African Americans, but not all.
Fear is something that we have to learn how to deal with.
That's Mark Hicks. He was an Oakland police officer for 30 years. He's from Oakland originally. He lives in Antioch, and he's a black man. He came to speak at the forum tonight to share his perspective as an African American cop.
You have to realize that from the perspective of an officer, every day that we put on that bulletproof vest and that badge and we wear that gun on our hip, it's a situation where you realize, hey, you might not return home from work that day to your family.
That's a comment Antioch resident Shamira Furman kind of took issue with.
What's frustrating to me about hearing fear from police officers is if you don't think that we go through the same fears. We understand you guys do. You choose to be in this position. We don't always choose to be in our neighborhoods that we have to walk through just as you do. We don't have bulletproof vests. We don't have guns to protect ourselves. So when I hear police officers talk about, hey, you don't know what we're going through, we got to think of all these different options, so do we. So do we. And that's not fair to assume that we don't. We have to teach our kids the same thing. Sorry. I just had this conversation with my 14-year-old. So, excuse me.
Mark, the retired Oakland police officer, he tells Shamira he hears her. And here's what's remarkable, but perhaps not surprising. These two kind of know each other. Those same blocks Mark used to patrol in Oakland, that's where Shamira grew up.
I recognized you before I got in here, don't worry.
Two people, both from Oakland, who both, in different ways and for different reasons, found their way to Antioch. After the forum is over and Shamira is standing around chatting, Mark comes up behind her. He puts his chin on her shoulder gently, sort of surprising her, really just saying hello. It's a sweet gesture.
Did you get it out? I love it.
No, you gotta get it out.
As soon as I came in, I was like, I know him. A little less gray back then, but I know him. And not in a bad way. It never came out in a bad way.
You know what? You know what? Before, I always used to wonder, like, oh, God, was it in a good or bad way? But then one day I started saying, you know what? I wasn't a bad cop. Yeah, there's times I had to get physical, but I did what I was supposed to do. So
if those two hadn't been part of this migration from Oakland to Antioch, maybe this moment wouldn't have happened. There's something telling about these two finding each other here, in a black church, in Antioch.
That was reporter Sandhya Dirks with an excerpt from American Suburb, which is the first season of KQED's new podcast called Queued Up. You can learn more about the series American Suburb. Check it out on the California Report's Facebook page. It's a scary time for undocumented immigrants to admit they don't have papers, especially now when President Trump is vowing to deport immigrants in record numbers. And yet, across California, people are speaking out about their immigration status at very public rallies and protests.
Hello, my name is Hugo. I'm undocumented. Unafraid, unassured, and unapologetic.
Yadira, sin papeles y sin miedo. Undocumented and unafraid.
They call it coming out of the shadows. And it's a lot like coming out of the closet. In fact, as Zadie Stavely tells us, the youth-led immigrant rights movement has a deep connection with the movement for LGBT rights.
At her kitchen table in Oakland, Yahaira Carrillo leaves through an old photo album with faded pictures of a little curly-haired girl at school.
And that's me, after I came to the U.S., with my little diploma nerd from the beginning.
Carrillo crossed the border illegally with her mom when she was 7. Growing up undocumented, first in California, then in Missouri, Carrillo was taught to always be on her best behavior.
Any sort of wrong moves could result in
my parents getting deported, I getting deported.
But as Carrillo grew up, she ran into obstacles because of her immigration status. When she went to college, she didn't qualify for financial aid, so she had to work full-time to pay college tuition, and it took her 9 years to graduate. The DREAM Act would have given kids like her a path to a green card, but almost a decade after it was first introduced, the bill still hadn't passed. So Carrillo decided to start lobbying.
We had reached a point where we had to tell our own stories. We had to speak for ourselves because it was suffocating. You know, living in this place of fear.
Suffocating, like when you're gay and in the closet. Carrillo also knew what that felt like. She had come out as bisexual when she was 23. She says there are differences between the two, but
at the end of the day, both coming out as queer and coming out as undocumented, it's about living life on your own terms.
Many of the most outspoken undocumented youth activists who started the Dreamer movement are gay or lesbian. They began taking a page from the in-your-face civil disobedience of queer activist groups like ACT UP and adopting the gay rights concept of coming out publicly.
People need to know that queer people exist, and people need to know that undocumented people exist, and that we live next door, and that we brush our teeth, and that we floss or don't floss just like everybody else.
In 2010, Carrillo and four other young people put their bodies on the line. In the place they felt was most dangerous for undocumented immigrants, Arizona. They walked into Senator John McCain's office wearing graduation caps and gowns, sat on the floor, and said they would not leave until the senator agreed to co-sponsor the DREAM Act. Carrillo says a police officer tried to talk them out of it. "I have a son too," he said. "Think of your future. How will you get a job?"
And I remember one of us saying, "But you don't understand, that's the problem. We can't get a job."
They were risking everything. Carrillo and two others were arrested that day and turned over to immigration authorities. They were later released, but faced deportation. More protests were happening around the country. Another queer immigrant named Prerna Lal helped shut down Wilshire Boulevard outside Senator Dianne Feinstein's office in Los Angeles.
I did what I did because I didn't feel like there was an alternative for me. For far too long, we had been ignored or cast aside or marginalized.
Lal and her parents came from Fiji and overstayed their visas. Friends suggested she could get a green card by marrying a U.S. citizen. But same-sex marriage wasn't legal.
I was told many times to just, like, get married to just find a boy. And I was like, well, that's not me. That's not who I am.
Lal says the Dreamers risking arrest and deportation caught the attention of the country. And the president. In 2012, President Obama issued temporary protection from deportation for undocumented youth, known by its initials as DACA.
DACA's only in place because people fought for DACA to be in place. You know, Obama didn't wake up one day and decide to just do this on his own.
The fact that Dreamers have been, you know, unafraid to come out and share their story has had a tremendous impact on the entire immigrant rights movement.
That's Felicia Escobar. She worked in the White House and helped craft the DACA policy, which now covers 750,000 people. In his campaign, Donald Trump vowed to end DACA. But Escobar says as president, he's backed off.
As of now, it seems like DACA youth are safe. But, you know, they don't live in a vacuum. They're worried about their parents.
Lal and Carrillo both now see that fear and uncertainty every day at the Community Law Center where they both work. Lal is an attorney for undocumented students at UC Berkeley.
How are you both doing?
All right.
On this day, she's helping an American student and his Kenyan wife prepare for their upcoming green card interview.
They'll ask you, where were you born?
Kenya? Nairobi Hospital?
Nairobi.
Lal ended up getting her own green card through her U.S. citizen wife after the Supreme Court ruled same-sex marriage is legal. Carrillo has a visa now, too. But she says some who are still undocumented wonder if under Trump, coming out is too great a risk.
And that's real, right? But I think at the end of the day, we don't want to go back into the same place that we were before.
Undocumented youth and adults are still using the chant, undocumented, unafraid. Sometimes they end by shouting queer, trans, and unashamed. Many of these immigrants say even with all the uncertainty now, they've learned that silence doesn't protect them. For the California Report, I'm Zadie Stavely in Oakland.
So many immigrants are living on the edge, not sure how long they can stay in the U.S., worried about being separated from their families. Next week, we're going to devote our whole show to stories of immigrants in limbo. People like Mo. He runs a store in a small Central Valley farm worker town, selling everything from engine oil to cilantro and lottery tickets. He's from Yemen, and his best friend voted for Donald Trump.
At least you say you're sorry, you know?
I don't think I did anything wrong.
Yes, you did. Do you feel it now?
No, well, yeah. Yeah. You know, I do feel bad.
Tune in next week for a special edition of the California Report magazine. Catch it on air or subscribe to our podcast. Google the words Donald Trump and nightmare, and you get over 18 million results. Of course, there are those who believe Trump is the answer to America's problems, but there are others who feel quite the opposite. And some of them are carrying those negative thoughts and fears with them deep into slumberland.
And as I fall down in the ground, he tells his Secret Service to get rid of me.
Reporter Peter Gilstrap brings us the story of a Los Angeles therapist treating patients dealing with what she calls Trumpmares.
I am known as Dr. Dream. I'm not a doctor. I'm a hypnotherapist, but it's just kind of a fun name to be called.
That's Kelly Sullivan Walden. She's written 9 books on dreams, including Dreams and Premonitions, The Love, Sex, and Relationship Dream Dictionary, and It's All in Your Dreams. She does a lot of talk shows like Dr. Oz, and her 17-year practice seeing clients privately and conducting dream workshops has covered pretty much whatever goes on in a person's sleeping mind, including the Freddy Krueger-like presence of the latest resident of the White House.
Every time that I dream, there's always this man. Who are you?
The greatest president in the history of the United States, me, Donald John Trump.
I'm hearing a lot of Trump-related dreams. Once I started looking, I just started finding so many of them, not just in the people in my world, but beyond that.
Social media and the internet provide plenty of information to back that up. Trump has appeared in dreams as a tooth-yanking dentist, a horrible math teacher, the leader of a zombie apocalypse, a ranting Uber driver, and a man chasing you in Walmart. But Trump has sparked far worse visions in the night.
Sexual violation, deportation, dreams about Hitler, Stalin, Mussolini, or other no-faced dictators treating people like they don't matter. They kind of run the gamut. You know, the dream that Mariah had was a violent dream and a very scary, like a nightmare, a classic.
My name is Mariah Alexis Reyes. I'm 19 years old. I grew up in Highland Park my whole life. I went to Benjamin Franklin High School. Woo woo.
Reyes met Walden when the therapist gave a lecture at Reyes School in 2011. Over the years, they've discussed many dreams, but today they're focusing on Reyes' Trumpmare.
I had a dream that I was visiting the White House, and as I was walking, I saw Trump, and he sees me, and he stabs me in the stomach. And as I fall down in the ground, he tells his Secret Service to get rid of me. And no one knew I died and that he was responsible. I felt so devastated because I didn't even get to say goodbye to the people that I love.
So is there any place in your life where you feel helpless?
Walden and Reyes analyze the dream. They dissect the dream. They assess what Trump represents to Reyes and what she can learn from it all.
It makes me feel like I don't matter, like I don't have a voice.
This dream covers so many things. There's so many layers. You're dealing with your own heartbreak around the election and also kind of a lot of people feeling stabbed in the gut. But then I love that you're taking it to a higher place of, okay, what can I do about this? What does this say about me? And how can I become a better person as a result of this dream?
So there's really nothing to fear from a Trumpmare after all, but what about the vice president? Are people experiencing the terrifying specter of number two in their nocturnal world?
I haven't heard a single Pence nightmare. I imagine if Trump, if he is invited not to come back to the White House, then I think the Pence nightmares will begin.
To be fair, Walden points out that
there's a lot of Trump healing dreams. A lot of people like trying to heal him in their dreams, loving him, throwing flowers on him, even having sex with him to heal him. Somebody was breastfeeding him. And she said she was like, you know, in the dream, she was very maternal with him.
It seems that some Americans are reaching out in their nightmares, hoping, at least behind the wall of sleep, that the president can be saved. After all, we are a nation of dreamers.
The American dream is dead, but I'm going to make it bigger and stronger and better than ever before.
And we have that going for us. For the California Report, I'm Peter Gilstrap in Los Angeles.
Every month, the California Report's Susie Racho and our jazz critic Andrew Gilbert tell us about the latest from Golden State musicians. They're here with two new releases that put a new spin on the music of some jazz legends.
That's the Mark Masters Ensemble from their latest called Blue Skylight. And Masters is a trumpeter long based in Southern California. And on this album, he's featuring songs by the saxophonist Jerry Mulligan and bassist Charles Mingus, two giants. So how do Mulligan and Mingus stack up next to each other?
You know, you might think on first glance that it would be a little bit of a forced marriage, right? Because Jerry Mulligan is, people think of him as kind of West Coast cool, his work with Chet Baker. Charles Mingus, who was actually from Los Angeles or grew up in Los Angeles, is this volcanic presence on the bandstand, you know, shouting encouragement to his players. And yet these pieces work really well together. They both loved Duke Ellington. I mean, as does pretty much every jazz musician. And he puts Jerry Mulligan's gorgeous ballad, Strayhorn 2, and Charles Mingus' Duke Ellington Sounds of Love, these two just ravishing ballads, and you can hear what the two men drew from the world of Ellingtonia.
And I think he'd call most of Master's selections here deep cuts, in a way. I mean, they're not the best-known work from either artist. What do we learn from Mark Masters as an arranger?
One thing that makes this album different is he's usually worked with a large ensemble. This is a seven-piece group. In this case, he's just drawing on his Southern California band, so he gets to really showcase his guys on this album. Let's listen to Strayhorn 2, which features the baritone saxophonist Adam Schroeder.
That's the Mark Masters Ensemble from their latest Blue Skylight, and where the Mark Masters Ensemble reflects the vision of one man, the SF Jazz Collective is a group that's thrived in collaboration, especially among some big names.
The SF Jazz organization, this major presenter in San Francisco, they created this ensemble, it's about 12 years ago now, and every year they pick a composer to focus on, and they commission all eight members to arrange one of that composer's compositions, and they all write an original piece. So this last season, 2016, they focused on the music of Miles Davis.
So the SF Jazz Collective, since 2004, they've had this rotating cast of big-name players. It's loosely being led by Miguel Zanon, who is one of the founding members.
Exactly.
Right?
He's the last founding member left, so I think he's kind of the first among equals. He's certainly someone who has used the band just in an extraordinary way, and we'll listen to his arrangement of Nardis, this sort of mysterious Miles Davis composition, and in his hands, it sounds like Miles Davis went to a Serbian wedding. I mean, it's just crazy and beautiful and works.
Now, doing covers is a tradition in jazz. I mean, they're standards. But how big of a challenge is it to reinterpret this work, you know, by somebody as big as Miles Davis, let alone add to it?
Well, what both of these projects, SF Jazz Collective and the Mark Masters Ensemble, really show is that in jazz, arranging can be as creative an act as composing. And with most of these pieces, you really hear a musician putting their vision on existing material and doing something, in most of these cases, really successfully, really interesting with it. And you hear the pieces in a different way. I thought we could go out with a piece by trumpeter Sean Jones, a more recent member of the SF Jazz Collective, and it's sort of his tribute to Bobby Hutcherson, the great vibraphonist.
Andrew has more on the SF Jazz Collective's music of Miles Davis and original compositions and Blue Skylight from the Mark Masters Ensemble at californiareport.org. Thanks so much, Andy.
Great to be with you, Susie.
Andrew Gilbert is the California Report's jazz and world music critic.
And that's the California Report Magazine, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director is Susie Racho. Our technical producer is Seal Muller, with additional engineering from Katie McMurrin. The California Report's senior editor is Victoria Maulione. Our team includes Ryan Levy, David Marks, Julia McAvoy, Tyke Hendricks, Ingrid Becker, Ethan Lindsay, and Holly Kernan. I'm Sasha Coca. Thanks for listening. This is the California Report Magazine.
Support for the California Report comes from the James Irvine Foundation. Accepting nominations now for the 2018 James Irvine Foundation Leadership Awards at irvine.org. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose family foundation advances the wiser use of energy and natural resources on a planet where everything is connected. On the web at theschmidt.org.